take a look at how that position has changed over his decades in public life.
I'm very pro-choice. I hate the concept of abortion. I hate it. I hate everything it stands for. I cringe when I listen to people debating the subject. But you still, I just believe in choice.
But I'm pro-life.
You're pro-life, but you do think that there should be exceptions for rape and incest.
Yes, and life, you know, the health of the mother, the death.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
We got it back to the states. We did the Roe v. Wade thing, which they've been trying to get it done for 50 years. I got it done.
Right now, in a number of states, the laws allow a baby to be born from his or her mother's womb in the ninth month. It is wrong. It has to change.
Hold on. Can we get just that last part again?
Right now, in a number of states, the laws allow a baby to be born from his or her mother's womb in the ninth month. It is wrong. It has to change.
So the thing that Trump is objecting to in that case, that actually must have been a mistake, put it in the abortion montage, because that's not abortion. That's like human reproduction, he thinks. Like, he has a basic objection to how it works.
Yeah, he for him, children of men is actually a utopia. There's no more. It's not a dystopia. There are no more babies being born. I mean, sometimes, you know, in my lowest,
if they're being born in the ninth month, it has to change.
Hey, I gotta say though, you know, just pure facts here. Both my children were born in the eighth month, so like
actually, so was I. So maybe we're okay by his standard. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, no, I mean, like, I guess as Trump positions go, babies shouldn't be allowed to be born in the ninth month. You know, you should make sure they come out in month eight is not the worst take that I've heard from the man. Crucially, and I should say, I am Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Abbott, and our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World. And we are going to be joined in just a few minutes by Mean Gene Bajelan, the foreign policy machine, who is going to be joining us to break down a friend of the show, Ben Shapiro's recent video manifesto on foreign policy. Before that, I did want to linger on domestic politics for a moment. And of course, in particular, in that montage that we just watched of Trump clips, before he started sharing his general thoughts about how it's fucked up that babies are born in the ninth month, he was taking credit for the Supreme Court's decision to reverse Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision, which has had the effect of stripping women of the right to abortion in several states around the country. And is just one of many fun decisions that has been made by the increasingly conservative Supreme Court in the last couple of years. One that might be coming down the pipe. It's not at the level of the Supreme Court yet, but you know, one to watch is the one that I was writing about last week for Compact. So the article there, I think we have the graphic, is called Big Business's War on the New Deal. And this is about there's a lawsuit by SpaceX, which is, of course, one of Elon Musk's ventures, in which the SpaceX attorneys argue that the very existence of the National Labor Relations Board is essentially unconstitutional, and that the court should get rid of it. And this is an argument that's made. That's the case in federal courts that's made it, but it's also been made at the level of the NLRB's own administrative courts by Trader Joe's and Amazon. They've both made this argument that the NLRB is unconstitutional. As well as SpaceX. If this happens, this is going to be arguably the highest point of the 50-year counter-revolution They argue that essentially the problem with the NLRB is that it both sort of makes complaints in this sort of prosecutorial like way and also renders binding judgments, or different parts of it do. And so this is like combining different powers in ways that shouldn't be allowed or they think are unconstitutional. So in the SpaceX legal filing, they have a quote, which I think we also have a graphic for, from James Madison. They say, the NLRB's current way of functioning is miles away from the traditional understanding of the separation of powers, which views, quote, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands as the very definition of tyranny, which comes from the Federalist Papers, number 47, James Madison. Would you guys believe that Elon Musk's lawyers didn't read the Federalist Papers very carefully when they pulled out that quote?
Yeah, I would believe it based on how he's running a lot of his businesses lately, and how embarrassing some lawyers can be. So what did they miss, Ben?
Yeah. So I actually did, I'm a ridiculous enough nerd that when I was like reading this to write the article, I actually went and read Federalist 47.
What a chump you are after reading the material.
And look, I don't know what James Madison would have thought about the structure of modern labor law. I do know that he owned a bunch of slaves. He might very well have been on Elon Musk's side of this one, but he also thought of the abstract slavery was wrong, but that didn't stop him. In any case, I guess Madison was like the slavery equivalent of like, look, I know factory farming is bad, but I just like these burgers too much. I suppose if you did go back in time to ask Madison what you thought, first you'd have to explain the 100 years of American history that happened between his death and the National Labor Relations Act, and it would probably be a long conversation. But I will say, in Federalist 47, he's making almost exactly the opposite of the point that Elon Musk's lawyers are making. What he is doing is he's summarizing an objection that was made to the Constitution by anti-federalists who are saying, no, the U.S. Constitution is bad because it allows overlap between these different spheres, the executive, legislative, and judicial. He's like, okay, if it concentrated all power and all of them in these hands, I agree that would be bad. That'd be the very definition of tyranny, but it really doesn't. The overlap is more limited, and some overlap, he argues very explicitly in Federalist 47, some overlap is fine. And so certainly you think about how the NLRB works. Does it concentrate all power, executive, legislative, and judicial in the same hands? Well, not really. I mean, it's the actual members of the board are appointed by the president. So it's not like they appoint their own successors. The institution is created by law and could be done away with by other laws by Congress. In fact, not only does it not concentrate all judicial power, but fun fact, as I'm sure Jake is very aware from his other his non-GTA activities as a union organizer, the NLRB doesn't even have the power to issue fines, right? They literally can't even do that. They can, like, if you're illegally fired for union activity, they can order the company to reinstate you, and they can order the company to give you back pay, but like they can't, but they can't even assess financial penalties beyond that. And of course, NLRB decisions, once they're made, the rulings can then be reversed in federal courts and, sometimes are.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how likely this would be to eventually go through? I've seen it kind of on the radar, but I was trying to ostrich this because it would be too terrible.
Yeah, it's relatively early phases still, but it is in federal court. It does seem like the kind of thing that I think the Supreme Court might enjoy ruling on. So I could see it happening. And of course, what they really want is that, if you are, essentially this is a bid to knock out the last few remaining teeth in American labor law, by, if SpaceX and Amazon and Trader Joe got their way, then you would have to, if you were like illegally fired for union activity, to get your job back, you would have to wait for there to literally be a federal case, right? You know, that like you'd have to wait for the federal courts, which could take years to happen. And by the time it happened, even if you won your case, I think the point would be effectively made to any of your coworkers who are thinking about, you know, following your example.
So there would still be labor laws in place in the sense of like you could legally form a union and stuff like that. It's been a few years since I've really. So the biggest thing you're thinking or is the regulatory aspect of, hey, don't fire somebody for union activity, because like that one check you're saying would basically be get drawn out over such a long period of time that like all of the regulatory functions NLRB can do with a little bit of speed at this point would just completely go moot and give some like way more power to the companies is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Like the sort of fundamental like labor laws would theoretically be about what they are. It's just that they wouldn't really be enforced even to the extent that they are right now. So that seems like it would be really bad to me. The sort of basic argument they're making that it's like, oh, this is bad because they, you know, have their own administrative courts and they could issue rulings until the federal courts reverse them is an argument you could make against literally any regulatory agency. So the implications are already also really bad. Like, could you have an EPA on this argument? It's not clear to me. The whole sort of thing is really grotesque because, you know, at the end of the day, right? Like, you know, if you read like the SpaceX filing, or you read like the Federalist Society has some stuff you can find on their website where they're like backing up the argument, all this, it really is this very topsy-turvy view of the world where, you know, Elon Musk, who owns SpaceX, Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, and the third one, Trader Joe's, is owned by the Albrecht family, who granted are peasants compared to the other two. You know, so Elon and Bezos both have net worths that are hovering around $200 billion. The Albrecht family altogether only have about $54 billion. Although to put that into perspective, if you're a middle-class professional who earns $100,000 a year, it would take you 10,000 years to earn $1 billion. So, you know, so if you think about this, that's the, you know, 540,000 years it would take you to get that Albrecht family net worth. You know, it's still, you know, I think these people are still, you know, doing okay. And, you know, they're in this position where they're basically portraying themselves as like hapless peasants being tyrannized by the NLRB as they're fighting for their fundamental freedom to fire cashiers and warehouse workers, without, you know, like in violation of the law without being caught very soon. All of which is to say, that this is, I think those two cases, the one that already happened, overturning Roe v. Wade, and the one that might be on the horizon, you know, within the next couple of years, possibly overturning key sections of the National Labor Relations Act and sort of knocking the legs out of the, you know, one of the cornerstones of the New Deal. I think both give you some sense of what the stake is with left critiques of the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, which sets up the one segment I want to do before we bring on Gene, which is that last week I was a guest on Dan Abrams' show on News Nation. That was the same show I went on after Kissinger died to argue with the guy for the American Conservative. In this case, Abrams, you know, I think I can say this. Basically, what his producer told me is he wanted to, you know, I mean, he has a very this is me, right? This is not what the producer said, but you know, he has very centristy branding, and you know, the producer said they were looking for a leftist to come argue with him about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, And since I'd written some articles in Jacobin in the past where I say the Supreme Court has way too much power, et cetera, and I'd been on for the Kissinger thing, they thought of me. And so, yeah, it was fine. I mean, we'll talk about it a little bit more when we watch it, but it's, you know, the sort of most surreal aspect of it for me is that the segment just before mine, the guest was Geraldo Rivera. So, that was, it's like, oh, hey, that's weird.
You made it big. You made it big.
Did you hit him with a chair?
That's what you're supposed to do. Yeah. I was on Zoom, but I still managed to, I paid somebody where he was to hit him with a chair.
Okay. It's only part. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Just it's what you're, you know, it's, I just want him to know that I know and respect his body of work. Right? All right. So let's watch the first part of News Nation.
Now it's Ben Burgess, a progressive commentator and host of the show Give Them an Argument. Thanks so much for coming back on the show. Appreciate it. All right. So what am I getting wrong here?
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. So to my mind, one thing you're getting right is when you say that the central question is not whether we agree or disagree with the rulings. I would say that the central question is who should get to decide. We were talking not about like financial penalties for individuals like the cases that you mentioned, but core policy issues that matter for our entire society, like whether women have a right to choose nationally, whether we're going to chip away at labor unions' rights to strike, which is what a Supreme Court decision last year did, whether we're going to have like meaningful anti-corruption laws. The Supreme Court's going to make that impossible. The question should be, I was going to say, the question should be, is this something we should decide democratically, which is how most liberal democracies like Canada or the UK, for example, work? Or should we invest all this power in this elite institution?
All right. So that's a disagreement that you have about, A, I guess, the structural issues, but B, the cases that the court has agreed to take and hear. Do you then agree with me that these claims of the illegitimacy of the court are just very bad for the country as a whole?
I don't. I think that it's bad for the country as a whole if we don't get to democratically decide these things, if instead you have 9 people who are almost always graduates of Harvard or Yale appointed for life, getting to act as a super legislature overturning democratically decided public policy. I mean, like, just one quick point about this, read the dissents in any of these major cases, not Marjorie Taylor Greene got some fines and they upheld it, but cases that actually decide important policy issues for the entire country. These are obviously things, oftentimes they're party line votes. The conservatives all vote one way, the liberals all vote the other way. Any decent constitutional lawyer can make an argument on either side of that. So I think the idea that this is a sort of body that floats above politics just doesn't really make sense.
Yeah. So I should say the opening monologue before he brought me on, he was talking about, the Supreme Court doesn't always do the right wing thing. The Marjorie Taylor Greene got a fine for not wearing a mask in Congress when House rules said she had to, and the Supreme Court upheld the fine. So there you go. And it's like, yeah, okay. But I'm like really slightly less interested in whether Marjorie Taylor Greene has to pay a fine than I am in like whether the right to abortion exists in all 50 states or, you know, whether we can have labor unions.
And I assume, obviously this is the point of what he's saying, but even if if the Supreme Court was, you know, ruling in favor of pro-choice and favor of labor, still theoretically, right, it's not extremely democratic, right? Even if it was ruling in ways that we might like.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, I would obviously, if we're going to have a Supreme Court, I would rather have that Supreme Court uphold important rights than not. Right. But I also think that it's really important to recognize, because most people don't. Right. It's like, what's the old joke about how God invented war to teach Americans about other countries? Right. That like I think most people who have this discussion are really myopic about how unusual the American system is in this respect, right? Like, most liberal democracies do not give their high court anything like this much power to decide public policy. And so, you know, people will sort of paint this picture. It's like, oh, you don't think the Supreme Court should have this much power to overturn laws that, you know, so, you know, but then, like, wouldn't we just turn into like a dictatorship, or we wouldn't have free speech anymore or whatever? It's like, I don't know. The high court doesn't have that kind of power in Canada, right? I think the Canadians are okay, right? Like, it's not 1984 up there. I've been to Canada many times.
I don't know. You might have to use certain pronouns if you're a professor in a university, which is basically, you know, Brave New World, Draconian.
I was watching Alex Jones, and Justin Trudeau is threatening to arrest people who speak out against the administration, according to him.
Is Trudeau going to personally oversee the firing squads?
You know, I didn't get that far in the video.
Good for you, Andy. Good for you. You cut yourself off for the night. But we do have part two. Is
there the little egg timer rang.
Yeah, let's watch part two.
No, look, that I agree. Look, I get it. And I'm not going to say, oh, the court just decides things based on the law. There's no such thing, right? Everyone has their bias. And in particular, I think that the courts in general have allowed their personal views, right, to come into play in assessing. But I want to keep coming back to what I view as the most important issue here, right, is this claim of illegitimacy, meaning it scares the heck out of me when people on either side, when I hear the governor of Oklahoma say that you can reject a Supreme Court opinion, when I hear AOC talk about the illegitimacy of the court. It scares me because we need somebody to be the decider in the end, because there are going to be some difficult issues, I think, that are going to be coming up in the years to come, and even maybe in the months to come, maybe over this election. Who knows? But whether we agree with them or not, we need someone to make those decisions. And I think these justices have shown that even though it's a very conservative court, they're not just going to make decisions purely based on partisan motives.
Well, I don't think they're necessarily going to make decisions based on purely partisan motives in individual cases like the ones involving Marjorie Taylor Greene or the Trump lawyers, where there are right. less controversial legal principles at stake. But I do think that they're going to make political decisions when it comes to these giant questions with society-wide implications, like should women have a right to choose? Like, should right. we uphold, you know, the like structure of labor laws that's existed since the 1930s that the right is trying to undermine right now? And I think when you have a court that has been on a tear on those kinds of questions of aggressively imposing, you know, right-wing policy preferences, then I think it makes a lot of sense that that people that you have this sense of illegitimacy, this sense of, hey, wait a second, on questions like that, shouldn't democratically be the final deciders?
Here's what I appreciate about what you're doing, right? You are not doing what I hear others do, which infuriates me so much, which is to just say that the court is illegitimate. You are criticizing the way that you disagree with how the court does what it does. And everyone is entitled to their opinion on that. Ben Burgess, thank you very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, that last part kept making me think about the Simpsons episode where they visit Australia and Marge tries to order coffee. And they say, oh, beer? She's like, no, coffee. Yeah, beer. Oh, no, coffee. Beer? Right? Like, I don't know how much clearer I could be than I was that I think that the kind of power we give to the Supreme Court is illegitimate.
Yeah. He definitely did it, grok, intentionally or unintentionally, what you're putting down. I do think he's conflating two issues. Let me know if what you think. Yeah. One is illegitimacy of the court, as in the court has ruled something and I'm going to disagree with it. Like, I'm literally not going to follow it, versus like, should the Supreme Court like have this much power? Should we, you know, maybe democratically dismantle some of those powers? I just think those are two separate issues. And what he was saying is basically that he thinks that like, we're going to need the Supreme Court in order to like make sure that democracy continues. And he's worried about like individual states not going along with like the results of the election or something like that, which is, again, I think you might agree with, like, oh, certain laws are so terrible that maybe, you know, no one should follow them. But I just think those are two separate. He was kind of scaremongering about like a lawless society, which is not even technically what you were saying. You weren't opining on whether, you know, we should follow those laws or not. What's, you know, in the current state that they're in. Do you know what I mean? That seems.
Literally, I just want to have the kind of balance of power between courts and elected bodies that they have in like Canada. Right. Like this is, or again, the vast majority of liberal democracies where like maybe sometimes you have what they call weak judicial review, which means that, you know, that the courts, you know, sort of look at the constitutional questions and then throw it back to parliament or whatever. And, you know, but they don't necessarily have the final say. Right. Like, I think that the sort of degree of power that we give our high court in the U.S. is extremely unusual by global standards. And, you know, I think it does operate as something of a, you know, it's like the Islamic Guardianship Council in Iran, right? This is like the Capitalism Guardianship Council, right? That you, that if the interests of the powerful are, you know, being meddled with too much, you know, you can always get them to rule against it. But yeah, no, I agree with your point, right? Like, in fact, in where he was talking about the Oklahoma guy saying, you know, blustering about like disobeying Supreme Court decisions, which, you know, we'll see if he actually does that. But like when he's talking about that, he's talking about AOC, he's equating two wildly different things, right? The stuff that like AOC was saying is like, yeah, like she maybe wants reforms that would sort of push back against the degree of power that's exercised by the Supreme Court, like maybe expanding the number of justices or having term limits. But that's a completely different thing from like, oh, you know, if the court rules the wrong way about some Trump thing, we're just gonna, you know, I don't know, take to the streets and, you know, like overthrow the government or whatever that, you know, he was gonna do, which is like, I don't know, man. I think the total number of people in the country who are actually prepared to do that is pretty low from what I can tell.
A lot of them are on Twitter, or at least they claim to be. I think 99% of them, 99% of people who would claim that they're ready to do that are tweeting up a storm right now.
yeah, exactly. Well, we will actually see who's ready to make the transition from, you know, from posting to dodging enemy fire. But in any case, we are now joined by a world-class poster who could doubtless dodge enemy fire just fine if he were called on to do so, Mean Gene Bajalan. Jake and Andy, I'll see you guys in the postgame.
Greetings.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing? I appreciate the new moniker you gave me as a world-class poster. And I'm also glad to hear that people are using the Guardian Council comparison when talking about the Supreme Court, because there really is a comparison over there. The rule of the jurists, that's what they call it in Iran.
Yeah, no, I think so. Like this is, you know, people... Like there's this sort of liberal civics class idea of the Supreme Court. That's like, oh, this is good because it'll protect the rights of unpopular minorities. I'm like, I don't know, man. Like if what you mean are like racial or religious minorities, sometimes they do the opposite, right? Sometimes it's going to be Brown versus Board of Education. Sometimes it's going to be Plessy versus Ferguson or fucking Dred Scott. But I've got to say, historically, the unpopular minority they've most consistently intervened in order to help has been rich people.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, they're like your DM in Dungeons & Dragons. You may be correct in your interpretation of the rules, but if the DM decides that's not the rules, not much you can do about it, even when you're correct.
Fair enough. So I thought it would be fun to have you on because I saw that a friend of show, Joe, you know, Benjamin Shapiro, had done an episode of his show that apparently lays out his foreign policy worldview. That's what he said. And I'm sure, you know, as one of the foreign policy analysts that I've learned most from, I'm sure we could learn together from other Ben's insights on this. So let's give it a whirl.
Is that dictators can hold the line. Even one of the great qualities of dictatorship is that dictators can hold the line even as democracies start to fade. That, of course, is the theory of pretty much every dictator across history when faced with a democratic rival. That is certainly the theory of Vladimir Putin today, whether it is in Ukraine or whether it's with regard to him just killing, you know, the people who oppose him, people like Alexei Navalny. And it is becoming very clear this week that Vladimir Putin is now settling all family business. This is the week where he feels like he has the ability to do exactly what it is that he wants. And the reason he feels that way is because of a combination of splits on the right in the United States and a combination of splits on the left in the United States, as well as splits in the European coalition with regard to Russia. When Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, there was pretty much unanimity that this was not something that the West could allow to stand. You couldn't have Vladimir Putin simply waltzing into Kyiv, taking over the country, killing Vladimir Zelensky, and essentially setting up a puppet dictator and turning Ukraine into a second Belarus. You couldn't have that because it would put Russia directly on the borders of a wide variety of NATO countries, including Hungary and Poland. You couldn't have it because it would certainly threaten former Soviet satellite states like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all of which are deeply fearful of a Putin-led incursion into their territory, Finland as well. You couldn't have it because Ukraine actually is a relatively major producer of products like wheat and oil. And mostly you couldn't have it because Vladimir Putin has interests that are antithetical to those of the West. And for all of the talk about over the last 25 years about how Vladimir Putin was just on the cusp of moderating, how there was going to be a moment when Vladimir Putin was welcomed into the family of nations, and then he would just be nice to everybody. That never happened. Every single president of my lifetime has tried a reset with Vladimir Putin. George W. Bush famously looked into Putin's eyes and thought he had a sense of his soul. And then you had Barack Obama, who literally sent Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State, to Moscow to give them a button that didn't actually say reset, but was supposed to be a reset button. And then you had Vladimir Putin being offered flexibility by Barack Obama in 2012 in the lead up to the 2012 election. And then Donald Trump came into the office, and the basic assumption was that Donald Trump was going to lead to a warm relationship with Putin. And now you have Joe Biden, who came into office and was immediately pretty soft on Russia in terms of sort of geopolitical strategery.
One of the things that, you know, that hits me about that immediately is, you know, I kept thinking of the, you remember the Seinfeld episode where they, talk about the uses of the phrase yada yada in conversation, you know, which
I've not really watched Seinfeld, so I do not know that episode.
Fucking Brits. Yeah, Gene, if you're gonna live in our country, you need to
have to learn your ways, which is exactly. Apparently Seinfeld.
Yes. So there's this big discussion of telling stories, and you say, oh, this happened and then this happened, yada yada. And like which things it's sort of okay to yada yada away. And, you know, in that he just yada yadas away the entire Trump record on relations of Russia, which seems like, you know, it would have considerably complicated the story he's trying to tell here.
Yeah, I think various American administrations have tried to reset with Putin. Obviously, that hasn't worked. But the reason they're resetting with Putin every time is because Russia is not one of those countries that you can just willy-nilly isolate for no reason. You know, the isolation that Russia has today, which is far from absolute, is a product of a very specific set of events and violations of international norms. But, you know, even that hasn't really pushed the needle on it. that much. Russia still trades with the international community. And for some reason, the Germans seem to think if they buy the Russian natural gas through Turkey or another country, that that somehow washes it. So this trade is all still taking place. But yeah, it's a kind of misleading narrative of what's going on. I mean, on one hand, yes, you know, Russia has intervened in the affairs of its neighboring countries. You know, part of it we can see as a response to the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes. You know, the war in Georgia perhaps wouldn't have happened if the United States hadn't gone into Iraq without, you know, even a plausible reason for going in. You know, the United States could have got away with going into Afghanistan after 9/11, but Iraq was seen as a real violation of that those international norms. So, you know, he's following that particular pattern. And the notion that, I don't know, I just find it not super plausible that the Soviet, you know, that the Putin's trying to rebuild the Soviet Union and that he's trying to, he's mm-hmm. planning to intervene in Finland and Poland and places like that, at least militarily. And if anything, this war has taught us that, you know, Russian military capabilities aren't to be sniffed at. But the fact that they're still 2 years into this war and, you know, there's no clear sign of victory, really, I'm kind of skeptical that a Russian military intervention into the Balkans or into Finland or into Poland is particularly on the cards. So,
yeah, I mean, the initial attempt to take Kyiv and impose regime change was defeated kind of right away, like to a certain extent before Western aid, new Western aid, right, beyond what had happened before, could even play that much of a role. I mean, it was it seems like that's been, and yes, as you say, you know, Russian military capacity is nothing to be sneezed at. I mean, they're certainly in a position to keep grinding away at the war, but like it does seem like, you know, the, like, even, you know, what was supposed to be, you know, it's like, oh, this isn't even really a war. This is like a, you know, few weeks long, you know, special military operation, did not, you know, work out that way at all. My sense is that, you know, if Russian military capacity had been what it was in like 1991, that would have been one thing, but like, it seems like over the decades, probably like everything else in Russian society, that's, you know, been institutionally degraded and, you know, and just wasn't there. And since spring of 2022, like taking Kyiv, doing regime change has been really off the table. And the question is more like, where's the eventual border between Russia and Ukraine going to be in the Donbass? So it seems like, given that even Ukraine is like a years long grind that's not going to end in complete success, the idea that, you know, other Ben is spinning here, that, you know, that like, if we don't, you know, if we don't hold the line and, you know, we listen to these voices on the right and the left, these talking about, you know, who are too isolationist, that, you know, Russia is just going to be sweeping through Lithuania and Finland, is just, you know, this really does not seem in touch with reality. I mean, just in terms of capacity, like forget desire, just in terms of like what they have the actual ability to do, it doesn't seem within the realm of reality.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like you say it's a plausible, you know, military option for the Russians. I mean, my good friend Harun Yilmaz, who works on Russian history, a historian of Russia, he didn't believe that the war would take place. But for the right reasons, in the sense that he was like, this isn't Georgia. The Ukrainians have been armed by Obama and Trump over the years, and it's going to end up in a kind of meat grinder. And that's why the Russians aren't going to do it, because they know they've only got one bullet. And once they fire that bullet, you know, their military capacity and ability is going to be exposed. So, you know, this notion of Russia as an existential threat to specifically the United States, it seems a little bit misleading. Now, if you're a country neighboring Russia, sure, you're going to be concerned. You know, a lot of the discourse around, like, you know, pro-Russian discourse is, you know, the Russians were provoked Well, yeah, you can say that, but equally you can say all their neighbors are being provoked into cozying up with the United States and the Western Bloc as well, because, you know, that's the nature of interstate conflict. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So if anything, you know, Russia has kind of shot itself in the foot and has, and it might eke out some kind of Pyrrhic victory in Ukraine, but it would seem madness for Putin and his regime to go on any further military adventures in Western Europe. Maybe they'll mess around in Central Asia, but that will upset Chinese interests in the Caucasus. But then again, you know, Russian influences in the Caucasus seems to be somewhat waning, with, you know, countries like Azerbaijan being able to kind of humiliate Russia over their violation of the ceasefire pertaining to the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, which ended in that ethnic cleansing of the Armenian population from there. So, you know, from the, you know, putting your American patriot hat on, you know, if you're looking from American, from the American perspective, is Russia really that big a threat to the United States? Is it even a threat to, you know, the powers of Eastern Europe these days?
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, it's, you know, I mean, Russia, you know, there is definitely an element of, you know, imperial bullying and its relationships with some of its immediate neighbors. And I know some leftists don't like it when you say that, because they think that, like, there could only be one empire at a time. And if you're not the global behemoth with hundreds of military bases everywhere, then nothing, you know, nothing you do can count, right? But I don't think you need that, right, to sort of...
Right, you don't need the argument.
Dominate, you know, some immediate neighbors. But, like, that's a very different thing from saying that it's, like, some great Hitlerian threat of, like, world conquest. I mean, that's just not real.
Yeah, I mean, people love to use the World War II analogies. It seems to be we're living still in the shadow of World War II. But really, you know, it's a very different state of affairs around the globe. And it just seems to me that I can't seriously believe that, you know, military planners regard Russia as, you know, some kind of existential threat to the United States or even its allies in NATO. I think if they marched into Poland, I think they'd have a really tough time, even if they were just fighting the Polish, who have a much more modernized army, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And of course, you know, never attacked a NATO country and presumably wouldn't. And yeah. So I did want to point out from earlier that when Shapiro is going through his capsule summary of different administrations' relationships to Russia, he says that, so he talked about, you know, he sort of accurately said that, you know, that early on, you know, Bush and Putin were buddies, or, you know, at least Bush thought they were. He looked into his soul. But then, like, the only data point from the Obama years that he mentions is that gesture with the reset button. But certainly one would think it would be relevant that, you know, Obama, you know, very openly backed, whether you want to call it a coup or a revolution or whatever, you know, they, very openly backed the overthrow of the pro-Russian
government,
government in Ukraine. And, you know, started the process of, you know, arming them, you know, for the subsequent war against pro-Russian separatists. And then, like, when he talks about Trump, I mean, you notice he spent like 5 seconds that talking about Trump, right? He barely said anything. The only thing he said about Trump was, oh, and people expected that relations with Russia were going to be good under Trump. It's like, here's the thing. What nobody talks about, because it doesn't serve anyone's narrative, is that Trump was a way bigger anti-Russia hawk than Obama was.
Russia was arming the Ukrainians. I think he opened the spigot on certain anti-aircraft weapons which hadn't been transferred to the Ukrainians. I mean, there was a real improvement in the military capacity of the Ukrainians between 2014 and the outbreak of this war. And, you know, that was partly because of a sustained policy from the United States to help reorganize the Ukrainian military into a more effective fighting force. And that's a bipartisan thing. You know, whatever and whatever Trump's personal relations with Putin were, they might have got on very well. But, you know, these are the these are the leaders of states. Right. And, you know, World War One happened when all the monarchs were like cousins from each other who had, you know, you know, months before the war had been hanging out and talking. And, you know, the Kaiser.
Like, literally, there's a famous picture of a bunch of them at one of their weddings that was like not very long before the war broke out. Yeah, totally. And yeah. And so, yeah, sure. I think that's a perfect analogy there. And it's like, yeah, they have Trump transferred weapons to Ukraine that Obama had held back from because Obama thought it'd be too escalatory. You know, Trump was...
And Obama had escalated by being so, you know, outspoken in supporting the Euromaidan. Whether you think it was a revolution or a coup, certainly the United States' vocal support for it helped, you know, legitimize the new administration that came into Ukraine at this time.
Without making a moral judgment on that one way or the other, that is just true, right? That Obama, you know, Obama made decisions that escalated U.S.-Russia, you know, tensions. There was a line which there were lines that Obama wasn't willing to cross that Trump was, as far as sending heavier weaponry. Certainly in terms, you know, I mean, Obama famously held back from bombing Syria, you know, after the red line was crossed. And, you know, Trump did bomb Syria, right? He was willing to do that.
Also did bomb Syria. He just didn't bomb Assad.
Oh yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Both bomb targets in Syria, but Obama was famously unwilling to bomb Syrian like regime targets, and Trump was. That was that famous, what's that thing where like the news anchor is gushing about how Trump became president?
Oh yeah. You know, yes, I remember it was something about the didn't they use a Leonard Cohen song to
say yes. Yes, guided by the beauty of the weapons. Yeah, I remember that. And and Trump was very aggressive at opposing, you know, Nord Stream 2. And, you know, and in general, right? I mean, like Trump was a pretty big anti-Russia hawk. And then, you know, when he gets to Biden, it's just like, you know, in this sort of neocon Ben Shapiro universe, it's just an article of faith that, of course, you know, Biden's a huge pussy and, you know, he must, you know, that like, you know, so he must just be rolling over and letting Putin do anything. But it's like, well, hold on. Right. Like this is certainly the most unpleasantly exciting U.S.-Russia relations have been since at least the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And for liberals in the United States, if anything, you know, the Putin threat is key to the self-identity of, you know, modern politics in the United States. You know, the whole narrative of Democratic Party supporting liberals is that there's this threat of fascism, the internal threat and the external threat, and the mastermind behind this threat is Vladimir Putin, right? So if anything, the hawkishness on Russia is really being propelled by liberals more so than neoconservatives who have framed it in this struggle against anti-fascism.
Yeah, which in fact...
Everybody's totally, right? Fighting fascism. Putin's fighting fascism. The United States is fighting fascism. Everybody is fighting the fascism. But for liberals, you know, Putin is the kind of hinge point of this global threat to democracy that we're hearing about, and which the only person I believe truly believes that there's a threat to democracy in the United States is Chris Hayes. Everyone else, I just don't believe they deeply, truly feel it.
Yeah, I mean,
but it is their story.
It is definitely their story, and it's really, I don't know. I always think of how much I liked that article that you and Michael Brooks wrote years and years ago about, you know, comparing Trump's Republicans to the AKP, because what I really like about it is that it's an attempt to nudge American leftists into learning a second analogy. That, yes, you know, like there are lots of bad and authoritarian things around the world. They don't all have to be the fucking Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the discourse around colonialism and imperialism and all these things are bad, but there are other bad things, you know?
Yeah. We shouldn't have to reframe every bad thing as the 1930s and 40s Europe bad thing in order to get excited about being opposed to it, right? We can just be opposed to lots of things for lots of reasons and, you know, say, yeah, look, there's definitely a disturbing authoritarian streak on the American right. But I mean, it doesn't have to be, not everything has to be Hitler and Mussolini to be bad.
Mm-hmm. As George W. Bush once put it, now that take has been proved false time and time again. Vladimir Putin is a highly intelligent, highly skilled adversary of the United States. His interests do not align with the interests of the West. The chief Russian motivation, and this has been true for literally centuries, is territorial ambition. This has been true since the time of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. I mean, if you want to go back even further, this has been true since Ivan the Terrible. In that the fact is that if you look at Russian history or have any sense of Russian history, Russia's great leaders are always measured by the amount of land they control, which makes a certain amount of geopolitical sense if you are Russia, because, again, Russia is a giant steppe, meaning it is open to invasion from all sides. And so if you're Russian, one of the things that historically you have attempted to do is expand your borders so as to prevent invasion from all sides. Now, at a certain point, that defensive justification becomes an offensive strategy in which you're invading sovereign nations that exist all around you and attempting to control top down. But Russia has always been an empire since the time of Muscovy. And now you are watching as Vladimir Putin tries to expand the boundaries of what he sees as his new empire. I mean, he himself compared himself to Peter the Great just a couple of years ago after the invasion of Ukraine. And when you watch the interview that he did with Tucker Carlson, where the first 35 minutes is dedicated to his idea of Russian claims to Ukraine, in which he actually sort of makes the claim that Russia has claims to Poland and Hungary as well. When he says that sort of stuff, we ought to take that seriously. He's actually spelling out what he actively thinks. Now, there are a bunch of people on the left who think that Vladimir Putin is doing this because he is offended by the muscularity of the West, that if only the West had been more conciliatory toward Vladimir Putin, then Russia would not, in fact, be an adversarial force. And everything that Vladimir Putin does is blow back to the West. That is the theory of people on the left who are very much vacillating with regard to what Vladimir Putin is trying to do. And then there are a couple of theories on the right. And those theories range from the blowback theory, people ripping that off from John Mearsheimer, the foreign policy scholar, who I think is wrong about a great many things. John Mearsheimer has sort of theorized that it's NATO's expansion that drove Putin to invade South Ossetia, for example, in Georgia, or drove Putin to invade Crimea and the Donbass region originally in 2014 and then invade the rest of Ukraine in 2022. Right? There's that theory, which, again, is coincident with the left wing blowback theory of American foreign policy that dates all the way back to people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. We'll get to more on this in just one second. First, free. You know that word? It should mean what it means. Free. And Pure Talk gets it.
I always love the commercials.
I love Pure Talk. That sounds exciting. I mean,
Also, it's just a little bit funny to me that when he's trying to think of like lefty radicals that things can go all the way back to, it's all the way back to a guy who died a few years ago and a guy who's still alive.
Yeah, but who's very old. I mean, I don't really know what to say about what he's saying. Yes, there are people who on the left, for example, who like to put all blame on for this conflict on, you know, NATO expansion. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's a complex set of factors in play here. Yes, perhaps, you know, Russian imperial ambitions come into play. But certainly the comparison with pre-modern rulers of the Tsarist Empire and Vladimir Putin are somewhat out of place. You know, Russia sees itself as a great power, and it sees itself as having the right to intervene in its near abroad. The Russians probably are not so bothered about whether these countries are formally independent or not, but want them to be in their sphere of influence. And then, of course, a lot of these former Soviet countries, you know, they have elements of their ruling class who want to move away from from Russian influence, not simply because of quote unquote anti-communism, but because, you know, there's a long history of repression of national minorities in Russia prior to the formation of the Soviet Union. Russia was in many ways the kind of guardian of the conservative order in Eastern Europe throughout the 19th century, you know, sent troops in to crush the revolutions of 1848, et cetera, all those kind of things. But, you know, it's a great power doing great power things, and it's coming into conflict with other great powers. And there are small nations caught in the middle who are trying to navigate between them. And if you're a country on the edge of the Soviet Union, probably many people in that country are going to see the threat of Russian imperialism greater than the threat of American imperialism, just as if you're in Haiti or Mexico, you're going to be a lot more concerned about what the United States is going to do than whether Russia is going to suddenly come and invade you. Your perspective on who the first order danger to your country is going to be shaped by where your country is located and whether or not someone is going to intervene which country has an interest in intervening in your country. So the fact that former Soviet republics, not all but some, are wary of Russia and sought to align themselves with the West, you may or may not agree with it. I'm not making a moral judgment, but it seems to be the kind of inevitable logic of a system of international relations based on the nation state.
Yeah, I mean, nations that don't have a lot of deterrent power of their own are going to seek out great power allies to protect them against, it makes all the sense in the world that you have like various Latin American, governments that have, sought out alliances at one point with the Soviet Union and even now might, have some strong relationship with Russia or China because it's in their interest to do so. And it makes all the sense in the world that, some of Russia's neighbors, seek out relationships with the West, of course. And look, it's not, as you say, Shapiro isn't wrong that, whether or not you want to attribute it to the specific figures he does, I mean, that might be a little unfair, but like, he's not wrong that there are people on the left who get a little simplistic about this and talk about it as if U.S. imperialism is the only source of conflict in the world, which is of course not true. And it's important to have a more nuanced view of this, but also, the U.S. is by far the most powerful empire in the world today, right? Nothing else comes close. And it does actually exercise quite a bit of influence over what happens. That doesn't mean it's all powerful. It's certainly not, right? But like, it's, if you're sort of an American who doesn't want various kinds of wars and conflicts to happen, it is actually not an irrational thing to say, I wonder if my country is doing stuff that we shouldn't be doing that makes this more likely to happen. And that would be a rational question to ask, even if the U.S. were only exerting a little bit of influence over the world, since it's still, the country that we live in and it's any influence that we could possibly hope to have, although certainly not much, is here. But, it's even more rational when the U.S. is this world, striding behemoth with hundreds of military bases spread around the planet, many interventions around the world, etc. And yeah, that doesn't mean that Maidan was something that only happened because of U.S. support. I think there is some, for example, I think there is this bad inference that people make where they're like, look, there was some National Endowment for Democracy money going to some actors that, played a role there. Therefore, like the CIA just like, willed this into existence. I don't think that's true, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, look, it's not like the United States is just sort of like hanging out, minding its own business. And then all these bad people who've got Ben Shapiro so exercised, you know, just act out, and the U.S. is only responding to it. It doesn't exercise any agency.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously you have a host of dynamics that, you know, led to this conflict in the Ukraine. And, you know, if we want to critique U.S. foreign policy from this perspective, perhaps the United States should not be getting involved in these countries because it serves to escalate them, escalate these conflicts.
And by the way, it's also bad for the people that we're intervening on behalf of, not just because of the escalation, but also because, you know, just structurally, you know, it's not like Ukrainians, for example, are in a position to, you know, it's not like, you know, the president has to worry about carrying Ukraine in the next election, right? You know, they're not, you know, in a position to sort of exert power over the United States, which is a built-in problem with interventionism, because even the people you're intervening on behalf of, oftentimes it's very cruel that, like, you know, because you're intervening when it's in your interest to do so, and like, while you know, there's like plenty of money sloshing around to do so, and then a few years later, you know, you might very well be in a position where it's like, well, we're not going to do this forever, and then those people are left high and dry, which is, you know,
the Ukrainians right now. It seems like everybody's forgotten about the Ukraine war. Nothing's passing. So,
yeah. And that's like a big, you know, that's like a horrible thing to do to people. I mean, if they, that, you know, I mean, if they, I mean, like if Ukrainians had made a negotiated settlement years ago, when it seemed like it was, you know, it was possible early in the war, then, you know, they'd be in a much better position now territorially and, you know, whatever, than like to have the U.S. be given the impression there was going to be U.S. support forever, and then have that eventually dry up, and now they're kind of fucked.
Yeah.
Killer leftism. That Russia, and then there is a theory that Russia is actually a bulwark against secular leftism. That Russia actively is a highly religious country that is very anti much of the left wing ideology with regard to, say, gender and sex and sexuality that the West has fallen for. And so they've built up in their minds, a lot of people, the idea that because Russians are socially conservative as a general matter, which they are, that this is somehow what Vladimir Putin represents, as opposed to, he has a population that is socially conservative, and also that is not his actual ambition. His actual ambition is not in defense of, say, social conservatism. His ambition is in defense of Russian territorial ambition. It's a category error, in other words, for many people on the right. Many people on the right have made that same category error, for example, with Sharia law countries in the Islamic world. It suggested that because those countries are, quote unquote, socially conservative, that somehow those countries have a commonality with, say, American conservatism, American Christian conservatism. And the answer there is no, they really don't. Their ambitions are not the same as your ambitions. And what this really reveals is a schism in the United States broadly writ, and in the West broadly writ, in Europe as well, a schism about whether the West has any sense of internal solidity. What are the values of the West? Because if Putin is able to split the West on the basis of perceived values or perceived anti-Westernism, and that says there are a lot of people in the West who really don't like the West very much, on the one hand, and a lot of people in the West who believe that the greater threat to the United States might be their neighbors who disagree with them about social politics, as opposed to people like Vladimir Putin. Not that Vladimir Putin is a direct threat to people in the United States, like right this instant, but he's a very large indirect threat to people in the United States because geopolitics actually matters. When you cut off shipping routes, when you destroy the sources of international trade, when you threaten American allies, these are things that actually will matter to American citizens writ large. Okay, so Vladimir Putin is figuring that the history of the United States since World War II is, if you can split the American public, you can win. And it doesn't matter how weak you are. All you have to do is outlast. Outlasting is the strategy. This has been true since Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. It was true of the Taliban in Afghanistan. It was true of Sharia law Iranian forces in Iraq. If you can outlast the United States, you will win. And the time for outlasting is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So it used to be that in order to outlast the American public, you would have to wait a decade. And now, because of the velocity of social media and because of the ability of people to see these arguments in real time and split from each other and polarize very quickly, what you're seeing is that the West is sapped of its will incredibly quickly on nearly every conflict. When there is a conflict with true evil, you see Western powers immediately leap to fight the evil and then pretty quickly start to doubt themselves and figure, okay, I think we're done here. We need to move on with our lives. Now, this would be a time when political leadership actually mattered, but there's a complete dearth of political leadership on both sides of the political aisle on these matters. Joe Biden is utterly incapable of articulating the rationale why Americans should care if Russia invades Ukraine. He does not even attempt to articulate it. He just spouts words like democracy without taking full stock of the actual situation for Americans. Because Americans look at Joe Biden say things like democracy and they say, wait, hold up a second. Ukraine, first of all, is an extraordinarily imperfect democracy. Right? The Freedom House score for Ukraine is like 39. Russia is like 7, but Ukraine is like 39. So it's not like an amazing wellspring of democracy. It is a burgeoning democracy at best. And so when you say democracy over and over, Americans are like, well, is that really what Ukraine is about? And then Americans say, well, if that's what Ukraine is really about, then why are we allies with, say, Saudi Arabia? Because Saudi Arabia obviously is not a democracy. By the way, a lot of our allies who are not democracies start to get very nervous when they hear democracy talk coming from Joe Biden, because they're like, OK, so what are you going to Arab Spring us over here? The real reason why the United States is pursuing a defense of Ukraine is because we have geostrategic interest in degrading the Russian military capacity to expand beyond its own borders, threaten shipping lanes, threatening supply resources, increasing the power of enemies of America and America's allies. Russia has formed a de facto coalition with China and Iran at this point. And that de facto coalition threatens America's allies all around the world and threatens freedom of the seas, for example, everywhere from the Taiwan Strait to the Straits of Malacca to the Red Sea to the Straits of Hormuz. Right? That coalition, it's extremely dangerous. And the United States does have a geopolitical interest in downgrading that. But that's not something that Joe Biden can explain because he can't say words anymore and probably doesn't understand the words that he is saying right now. And on the right, there's a split about whether these things even matter. There's this bizarre idea that has arisen on large parts of the right that America can become autarkic, that suddenly global economics don't matter at all. That if things go to hell in a handbasket with regard to the freedom of the seas in these particular areas, it won't affect American citizens in any way. Let me just explain. If shipping starts to be truly endangered the way that it is in the Red Sea, in any of the other areas that I just mentioned, the amount of money that Americans are going to pay is going to be so much larger than whatever checks we are signing to Ukraine, it will make your head spin. If you loved the inflation of the first couple of years of the Biden era, wait until freedom of the seas goes away. It's something that you're going to enjoy. Okay, so in any case, Vladimir Putin knows all of this because all he has to do is just keep pressing. All he has to do is keep pressing. And so he's taking full advantage. He sees the splits and he's exploiting those splits. Right? He's a smart player. Vladimir Putin is a smart geopolitical player who sees foreign policy as a zero-sum game. And no attempt to appease Vladimir Putin through happy talk is going to work. Again, I went through the various administrations in the United States since Vladimir Putin took office in 2000. Every single one of those administrations has tried a detente policy with Vladimir Putin, and all of them have failed. Because guess what? Every one of those administrations ends. Every one of them has a shift in Congress. And Vladimir Putin's still there, ruling in unitary fashion. The downside of dictatorship is it generally means a poorly run country that has no feedback loops for improvement of the country. You can list certain countries, by the way, that have had quasi-dictatorships that have actually run fairly well. That was true, for example, of Singapore for several decades. But it's very rare. More likely, it turns into a corrupt oligarchy in which the leader uses his position in order to enrich himself and his friends in order to ensure his own power and destroys his adversaries. And one of the best ways to maintain your own power is to destroy things like internal property rights and political freedoms. Because if you give property rights, that may lead to the creation of a monetary base from which a threat can mount against you. So Vladimir Putin has been very, very bad for the Russian people. If you don't believe me, all you have to do is look at the various GDPs per capita in the former Soviet satellite states. GDP per capita right now in states like Poland, right? Poland is a former Soviet satellite state. GDP per capita there is about $18,000. GDP per capita in Estonia, a former Soviet satellite state, is $28,000. GDP per capita in Latvia, a former Soviet satellite state, $21,000. GDP per capita in Russia right now is $12,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. Vladimir Putin has not been a boon to Russia. Okay, putting all that aside again.
None of that made any sense. So number one, it's quite funny that he is actually completely unable to articulate an ideological reason that we want to support Ukraine. So he leans on the material reasons, appeals to Americans' self-interest for if you want your cheap crap, then, you know, Russia's a threat to the seas. And then he cites the Red Sea now and what's going on in the Red Sea as being being an issue. But he's also tying this to the fact that China and Russia and Iran have created this bloc that is, you know, threatening American hegemony and threatening navigation off the seas. Well, number one, China cares very much about navigation of the seas. And I'm pretty sure the Chinese don't actually want to pay for that navigation of the seas protections. They're quite happy for the United States to pick up that cost and pick up that burden. Number two, what evidence is there that Russia is a particular threat to navigation of the seas? They rely on exporting their grain to large parts of the developing world. And in fact, you know, the fact that sea lanes were closed and there were sanctions caused extreme inflation in parts of the developing world as food supplies were cut off. So he's trying to make this material case that, well, you know, Russia's going to threaten navigation of the seas. I don't see it, right? The threat to the navigation of the seas will come from perhaps non-state actors or smaller actors who don't have a deep stake in international trade, but Russia and certainly China have a huge stake in the global economic system, in the global economic order, and also, to a certain degree, the maintenance of the American pointless empire. To us, you know, in the sense that they see, you know, they might not like American influence in general, but they probably aren't too unhappy with having some U.S. military presence providing security for their ships, you know, for their trade. Because where is all that trade going to? Where is it coming from? So it's a very misleading argument. He's trying to make it sound clever, saying, but it's interesting that he can't go to a kind of ideological point here. Because, of course, like he says, Saudi Arabia is a dictatorship. Ukraine is a very imperfect democracy. You know, whether a group or a country is democratic or not really has no bearings on whether the United States will support it. So he's trying to, what is it they call, a gish gallop. He's just throwing a lot of things out there that sounds like he's making a coherent argument. But he's not demonstrating any of his points. Where's the examples of the Russians blowing up ships or blowing up international connections? If anything, you know, the closest thing we have to that is the Nord Stream pipe. And I don't think the Russians blew up the Nord Stream pipe. And then when we look at the attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, historically, they come from places like Somalia, where you have a failed state in existence, and then more recently with the Houthis, and that's directly related to the conflict that's going on in Israel-Palestine, not really directly related to Russia. So, you know, if we want to bring in some World War II analogies, you know, America's, you know, Hitler initially didn't want to abolish the British Empire, right? He saw it as a defeat the British, but he saw the British Empire as a force for stability.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't. Originally, he thought he wasn't even going to have to defeat the British Empire. He thought he could, like, make a deal, you know, he thought he could cut a deal with it, and that, you know, that if he could basically get them to disinterest themselves in what happened in continental Europe, then, you know, then he always said, like, oh, why would I want the British Empire to go away? One, he was a big admirer of the British Empire, and two, he always said, it's like, look, if the British Empire collapses, you know, Germany won't really benefit. It'll be, you know, America and, you know, like, the, you know, other countries will benefit from it. So
if there is any part of the American imperial footprint that Russia and China would like to keep intact while dismantling other aspects of it, it will be the U.S. Navy providing protection for international shipping lanes. Sure, the Chinese might want the U.S. to pull out of Korea and Taiwan, no doubt. Maybe get out of the Philippines and give China a sphere of influence. But the Chinese don't want to have to deploy their navy to you know, the Straits of Hormuz or places like that. They're quite content to let the Americans deal with that. I think pretty much the same for the Russians. So his entire argument falls flat because he can't show an example of how Russia is threatening international shipping lanes. If anything, Russia wants to open up international shipping lanes so it can get things out of its warm water ports in the Black Sea and places like that.
Yeah. The other two things that struck me about this are, one, this whole thing that he's going off on about how GDP per capita is 18,000 in Poland and only 12,000 in Russia. I have no idea what point he thinks he's making there. It seems like something maybe like the lack of democracy is bad for the economy, although that seems very hard to fit with some of what he acknowledged elsewhere. It almost seems like there's some weird insinuation with that thing about property rights that he thinks that like Putin is doing like economic leftism rather than overseeing a gangster capitalist oligarchy. This all does seem very Gish Gallop-y.
And I would also note, I'm sure Ben Shapiro is very much in favor of sanctions on Iran, and those sanctions on Iran absolutely ensure that no independent financial basis for opposition to the Iranian government can come into existence, because it basically helps consolidate the Iranian regime, the Iranian economy in the hands of the regime and its allies. So he's pretty disingenuous about that, because I'm sure if we go back, we'll find Ben Shapiro big advocate of sanctions.
Yeah, of course. And I also the other point is the one that that I wanted to touch was the one that I saw I can't find anymore. I think it was the boss in the chat said this, that it is really funny watching how far Shapiro has to strain to differentiate his view on all this from Joe Biden's.
Yeah, I think the boss made the point that Shapiro basically supports the Biden policy, but his audience doesn't want to hear that Biden is doing what he wants them to do. So he has to like fabricate nonsense or moan about Joe Biden not using the right terminology. It's a pretty weak argument. He's just, you know, viscerally yelling about why aren't we being more muscular on the world scene. Well, Ben Shapiro, if you're so convinced about this, why don't you get your ass out there and do a USO show or something like that? Or go fight. Hey, the IDF are recruiting if you want some action.
The IDF are surely recruiting. There are definitely American mercenaries in Ukraine and American volunteers in Ukraine, you know, if you wanted to fight in that war. I think the opportunities for Ben to display his martial prowess and on the side that he prefers are just, they're waiting for him. But it's also just incredible because, yeah, I mean, what is it exactly that he wants the Biden administration to do that they aren't doing, right? I mean,
they're sending tanks into the Ukraine, deploy American soldiers there, deploy NATO soldiers there. I really don't. You know, like any.
What is it that goes beyond what the Biden administration has done that wouldn't put us in the last 2 minutes of Dr. Strangelove that Ben wants to do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even if you're the most vociferously pro-Ukrainian person, you have to understand that obviously there are going to be red lines for the Russians, which could have a really big dangerous effect on international stability. I mean, forget about freedom of navigation. If everyone nukes each other, it only takes one. So, you know, it's not that I'm super worrying about nuclear warfare, but like escalation is unpredictable. You might get away with it, but then you might get away with it until you don't. You know, dangerous policies seem genius until they don't work. I mean, to bring it back to Israel, you know, Bibi could make a really good case to his domestic constituency for a long time that he's dealt with the Palestinian issue and you don't need to worry about it. We've walled them off and we can forget about them. And that worked until it didn't work, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, yeah, I don't stay up at night worrying about, you know, nuclear war now, right? Maybe I did a little bit when this first started in 2022. Because it seemed really dangerous that we were crossing all kinds of lines that had not been crossed before in the history of U.S.-Russia relations. And, you know, and yeah, as you say, it's a dangerous game, right? I mean, it's like, yeah, probably you can get away with it, but there is that uncomfortable hitch in your voice as you say it, right? Because, yeah, we'll see. And certainly, you know, I mean, look, there is a reason why we haven't had direct shooting wars between nuclear armed countries since we've had nuclear arms, right? You know, that it seems like everybody is rightly terrified that those wars wouldn't stay conventional. And, you know, it's like, yeah, because short of that, what has Biden not done? He's imposed crazy sanctions. He's had, you know, he's poured, you know, more and more money and arms into Ukraine, including many times where it's like, okay, we're not going to do this because that's too escalatory. And then a month later, oh, fuck it, we'll do it.
Put it another way. If you're, and I have, you know, I have conservative friends. I talk to old neocons and things like that, who are like diehard Republicans. But even they, who, you know, in their honest moments will say, Biden's actually doing the best policy you can do. He's pushing the Russians right up to the line, but not going too far. The escalation is slow. You know, from a neoconservative perspective, Biden, and to a certain degree, you know, the Biden administration is doing exactly what, you know, you would want them to do, because you don't want American troops to be involved in that. But at the same time, you want to, quote unquote, degrade Russian capacities, limit them, you know, give them military humiliation. He's doing pretty much. And, you know, I heard this from a conservative, a personal friend of the Ashcroft family, said, like, you know, honestly, he was like, honestly, you know, I can't really complain about the Biden administration and their policy on Ukraine. And he's a guy who's been to Ukraine to do medical aid and stuff like that. He's like a you know, weekend warrior type of guy. And even he's admitting that, you know, this is the policy that if a Republican was doing it, we'd be praising it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Because, yeah, but like, what is the, like, you really can't put a piece of paper in between the position of old school neocons like Ben Shapiro and the Biden, you know, position on Russia, Ukraine, like, and you know, that's why, I mean, even Ben Shapiro isn't being like, oh, Biden is weak because he didn't like set up a no fly zone and start directly shooting down Russian planes. Cause I think even he realizes that would be insane. So, he's left complaining that Biden isn't using the right rhetoric to justify it. But then, even there, as you say, he's kind of floundering around because, like, what exactly is his objection to the Biden rhetoric? It's, you know, like, because he has to admit, well, Biden has been using sort of pretty much classic neocon rhetoric about this, right? You know, where it's all about democracy, et cetera. So to find an angle to attack him, Shapiro has to be honest about how little democracy has to do with it. You know, with the point about the Saudis, the point about how Ukraine is, sure, more democratic than Russia, but, you know, according to those Freedom House rankings he mentioned, less democratic than, you know, many other post-Soviet states even. You know, it's about the middle of the pack for post-Soviet states, less democratic than, for example, Viktor Orban's Hungary, not generally regarded as a wonderful example of democracy, et cetera. So it's like, okay, well, democracy doesn't have anything to do with it. So, like, now you're mad that Biden is talking about freedom and democracy instead of saying that, like, our economic
navigation of the seas, like, you want to say we have to defeat Russia and Ukraine for navigation of the seas.
Come on.
Which is like, okay, one, as you say, is just not even true, right? I mean, like, he can't come up with, you know, he has no concrete examples of, the, you know, how the issues are even intersected here. And two, even if it were true, look, if it was a purely pragmatic argument, it's not like this is, you know, instead of doing what Biden is doing, what most of the Ukraine hawks do, and talking about freedom and democracy, you just said, oh, pragmatically, it's like in our economic interests to oppose Russia. It's like, well, is that really going to be what's going to whip people up about supporting this? That I don't think so. I think that like the sort of rational response, if you're like, oh, we're worried about the long-term effects on, you know, the sea lanes or whatever, or, you know, it's going to be economically bad for us in some way. It's like, okay, well, if that's the concern, why not just make a deal with Putin to you know, keep the sea lanes open and, you know, and make sure that, you know, you're going to be taken care of.
I mean, if it was just about the money and the global economy, if the United States had just left Ukraine to Putin's tender mercies, you know, the global economy would have been far less disrupted.
Yeah, exactly. Like the thing that's disrupting the global economy is, you know, having the war drag on for this long, is all the sanctions and isolation of Russia. Like that's the stuff that causes all the big economic disruption, right? Not, you know, whether, you know, Russia holds sway over more or less of Ukraine, right? So it just doesn't even make sense on its own terms, but I guess he says it very quickly and confidently.
Vladimir Putin is winning right now because all he feels he has to do is outlast. Not only that, the weaponry that we are shipping to Ukraine in defense is much more expensive than the weaponry that Vladimir Putin is using in offense in Ukraine. We'll get to more on this in just one moment. First, are you struggling with back taxes or unfiled returns this year? Well, I've got some bad news. The IRS, the reason that Vladimir Putin is able to ramp up his production, which can last probably effectively another 2 to 3 years, at the levels that he is currently producing, they're spending like 6% of their GDP on defense, by which we mean offense, in places like Ukraine. That's unsustainable for an economy that's truly unworkable in Russia. They do not have a workable economy. It is 50% probably based on oil profits. They do have trading partners, of course, outside the West, but have they been economically damaged by the war in Ukraine? Absolutely. It's damaged everybody, but it has certainly hit Russia. You can see it in terms of the inflation rate, but the reality is that Russia can produce kind of crappy old machinery and ammo, and it costs a lot less money than defensive machinery. By the way, you see this all over the globe, right? It costs Hamas like $50 to create a Katyusha rocket that they can shoot into an Israeli city, and it costs Israel like $50,000 every time they fire an Iron Dome. That sort of stuff happens all the time across the globe. It's one of the reasons why the Houthis are being effective in the Red Sea right now. Offensive measures that are basic and dumb cost almost nothing. Defensive measures, which have to be sophisticated to stop the offensive measures, are very, very expensive, which is why, from a financial point of view, offense is better than defense. From a financial point of view, during war in the moment, right now, destroying the enemy's capacity to make war is actually easier than defending against the war that they are attempting to fight against you. Again, all of this is just predicate to the fact that Vladimir Putin really is feeling his oats right now. So not only did he almost certainly kill Alexei Navalny? I say almost certainly because, you know, you try to be a little careful about these things, but he killed Alexei. Alexei Navalny did not die of natural causes in a prison at the age of 47 after being poisoned by Vladimir Putin just about 4 years ago, and then immediately arrested upon his return to Russia, sentenced to a gulag for 30 plus years, and then he randomly dies. That is not the way that works.
Gulag, not a gulag.
Especially not for Vladimir Putin, who makes a habit of killing him.
What's that?
Not a gulag, anything but a gulag. You know, sentence him to a gulag. I mean, Ben Shapiro is being pretty ridiculous. I did want to hear about the tax services, but
yeah.
But I would trust Ben Shapiro on what is a good tax service. I actually have a theory that Ben Shapiro, on a personal level, is probably actually a really nice person. It's just the character he plays on TV, and he might give you good tax advice.
Yeah, I've. Yeah, I actually have something on that, but that's got to be an off-air conversation.
That's an off-air conversation. But, you know, it's quite interesting. I am very skeptical of his theory that offensive warfare is cheaper than defensive warfare. It kind of depends on the technological base of your military, whether you're doing offensive or defensive warfare. I mean, ISIS was doing offensive warfare, and they were, you know, not, they were often armed with sometimes with stolen U.S. Weaponry, but, you know, a lot of old weaponry as well. So, A, I'm very skeptical about that claim that he's making there about the cost of defensive versus offensive war. And secondly, well, you know, if we're selling all these weapons that we're making here in the United States, well, isn't that an economic argument for you know, that would be probably the economic argument he could have deployed to appeal to American self-interest. It's like, look, it's all about the economy, economics. The government is going to buy a bunch of weapons, right, from American companies and then give them to the Ukrainians and then do the same. And that's going to benefit some Americans who are working in the war industries, but that's kind of a less sexy argument, right? When you say, look, we need to support this war because selling weapons to Ukraine really juices up our military industrial complex. And that's a real employer in the United States. I would respect him more if he made that argument, to be honest.
Yeah, although you can kind of see why he does not, because I'm just trying to imagine, you know, like Joe Biden getting up, you know, later this week to do the State of the Union and being like, I know there's some people in this chamber who want to end aid to Ukraine. But
my 401k is in Raytheon stock.
And exactly, right? Like if he said that, right, that's... Well, you know, I would enjoy it, but I think that's about what you could say in favor of him making the argument from Raytheon jobs for current U.S. foreign policy.
His political opponents. And in fact, unsurprisingly, the Kremlin has now rejected international calls, according to Axios, for an independent investigation into Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's death in prison. Navalny's allies and family, of course, say that they suspect high-level Russian authorities were involved in his death, which, of course, is absolutely true, I'm sure. The European Council said Mr. Navalny's unexpected and shocking death is yet another sign of the accelerating and systematic repression in Russia. Kremlin has they've refused to release his body because they're afraid that if they release his body, then they're going to discover the poison on him or the bruises on him or the broken bones or whatever it is. The country's prison services said he died suddenly after a walk. They claimed he fell unconscious after feeling sick and could not be resuscitated. Of course, all of this has sort of outsized impact in the West because there was a very famous HBO documentary made about Alexei Navalny that won Best Picture best documentary at the Oscars just a couple of years ago. It is a very, very compelling documentary all about his poisoning and his attempt to track down the people who poisoned him, which he actually does. He actually calls one of his poisoners on the phone and gets them to admit the whole thing on the phone. The very tail end of that documentary, Alexei Navalny actually is asked, what is your message to the Russian people in case you're murdered? And here's what he had to say.
Здесь у меня просто очевидная вещь. Ну, не сдавайтесь. Не
he says, надо, listen, I've got something very obvious to tell you. You're not allowed to give up. If they decide to kill me, it means that we are incredibly strong. We need to utilize this power to not give up. To remember, we're a huge power.
Находится под гнетом вот этих вот чуваков.
That is being oppressed by these bad dudes.
Потому что ну мы не можем.
We don't realize how strong we actually are.
Все, что нужно для торжества зла.
The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil.
Добрых людей.
Is for good people to do nothing. So don't be inactive. Okay, and then he was murdered. So either his murder is a reflection of Putin feeling threatened, or his murder is a reflection of the fact that Putin thinks he can get away with nearly anything at this point. And it seems more like the latter, especially because they're not being shy about anything that they are doing right now. Vladimir Putin, according to the Russian news agency, the Russian government has now filed charges against Oleg Navalny, who is the brother of Alexei Navalny. They said wanted under an article of the criminal code. They did not specify what article Navalny's brother was even wanted under. So they're just arresting Alexei Navalny's relatives who are in Russia right now in an attempt to presumably quash any blowback from their decision to kill Alexei Navalny. Not just that, on Tuesday, Russia's main security agency said that they had arrested another American citizen. This person's a dual citizen of Russia and the United States on accusations of committing state treason by raising funds for Ukraine. The FSB identified the detainee as a 33-year-old woman who lives in Los Angeles. Apparently, she had raised $51 for a Ukrainian organization that bought weapons and other equipment for Ukraine's military. That's because she had sent $50 to Razom for Ukraine, a New York-based nonprofit organization that sends assistance to the country. And the FSB released via Russian state media a video that showed the woman wearing a white hat to cover her eyes being handcuffed and escorted by masked security service officers. If convicted, she faces 20 years in prison. And of course, this makes perfect sense considering that Russia is making just a bounty off of American citizens they kidnap.
But why,
if they arrest Brittany Griner for being foolish enough to fly to,
why does Ben care about any of this? This is like, again, another, you know, you're the logic man, Ben, but this doesn't seem to follow on from the argument he's making, because at the outset he said that, you know, this is not about democracy, et cetera, and we have allies with people like Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, let's talk about Saudi Arabia. Like, what's going on there with activists getting, you know, chopped up into pieces? And, you know, that guy, Khashoggi, he wasn't even that hardcore of an opponent. He was like a loyal opposition to the Saudis, or the internal repression that takes place there. He's bringing this up, but he's already said that it doesn't really matter. Like, you know, that the problem with Russia isn't that they have they're a dictatorship or an authoritarian regime, because he's already conceded we ally with pretty horrible regimes, including Saudi Arabia, which I would make the case is probably on a similar level of freedom to Russia, as in Saudi Arabia. And you like say something against that silly gnome project they're building, the big line city, you might end up fish food. So
yeah, I mean, it's certain respect.
Complete tangent from
Saudi is like, look, I don't want to, you know, this is not a defense of Russia, which is a extremely unfree and undemocratic place, but you know, in certain obvious respects, Saudi Arabia is actually much worse.
Yeah, so I just think it's a very he's being extremely disingenuous, because he's giving us this emotional story of Navalny, whether you like Navalny or don't like Navalny, whether you support, you know, the guy was killed under dubious circumstances in prison. But Ben, why does this matter? Because you've already told us that it doesn't matter. Trying to convince us that Putin is a bad guy doesn't have anything to do with the argument you set out at the beginning.
No, in fact, it's exactly the kind of argument you said you weren't going to set out, because, you know, you briefly understood for a moment that it wouldn't really be relevant to supporting U.S. policy that, you know, is, you know, Putin, you know, yes, I would be pretty shocked if Putin didn't have Navalny killed. But
hey, he might not. Putin might not have given the order. You know, people.
Not sure.
In a dictatorship, it pays to know what the leader wants without him asking for you.
Fair enough. But yes, but also, of course, you know, yes, Jamal Khashoggi being cut up with the bone saw is a pretty obvious example. And, you know, this is why in a certain sense, I'm a huge defender of whataboutism, which is to say that, yeah, I understand in the strict sense it's bad. If you're saying X isn't bad because Y is bad. Yes, that's silly. You shouldn't say that. But the kind of thing that people are often thinking of when they accuse each other of whataboutism is just sort of asking people to consider parallel examples and apply consistent standards. Right. And it's like, okay, well, yes, I think it's very bad that Navalny was, you know, poisoned and imprisoned and, you know, probably eventually murdered. You know, I also think, you know, I mean, without even going to as extreme a case as Khashoggi, right? I think it's very, very bad that the U.S. has extradited Julian Assange for doing journalism. But if we're going to probe for consistency here, the question to ask is, what would I want other powers to do in response to the Assange prosecution? And, you know, and that's like, do I want, and for that matter, what does Ben Shapiro want the Biden administration to do in response to Navalny that they're not already doing? I mean, like, you know, you have fewer cards to play once you've played them all. And it's particularly, I mean, it is particularly telling in this case that, you know, he when he had to like fish around for a place to criticize Biden, even though he completely agrees with Biden's Ukraine policy, he was like, oh, he's doing the wrong justification. But then it's like, well, the justification should really be about self-interest, not democracy. But then it's like, look, you can't have, like, how excited are people going to be by that justification? Not very, right? Like, you can, there is a reason why people keep going back to the well of World War II to justify everything, because that's something that, you know, that like actually strikes large numbers of people to this day is like, yeah, that was a cause worth dying for. Whereas if you say, oh, we have to do this because Raytheon provides so many jobs, you know, it's pretty hard for most normal people to get it up for that. And it's in this particular, you know, and so like even Ben Shapiro can't sustain it over the course of a single podcast episode. It's like, you know, he's not going to keep making the, you know, arguments about self-interest and shipping lanes. It's like if he wants to get his audience excited about this, even he realizes on some level he's not going to do it like that. He's got to do the freedom and democracy push and, you know, talk about Navalny.
To Russia with pot in her bag, and then they throw her in prison, they can get like an actual high-level Russian arms dealer released in return for that. They're still holding the Wall Street Journal reporter, Evan Gershkovich. They have no compunction about just randomly kidnapping American citizens. This is no problem for them. Why? Because they're not afraid of the blowback at all. We'll get to more on this in just one second. First, in a world filled with uncertainties, you should be prepared for any possibility. You need My Patriot Supply. My Patriot, real meat or gluten-free options. These kits provide over two. In Vladimir Putin's Russia, he was guilty of treason. Ukrainian intelligence officials warned Kuzminov his life's in danger. They urged him not to leave the country. Instead, he moved with his money to a small resort town on Spain's Mediterranean coast. And now he's been found murdered. He's 28, or was 28. Two Spanish police officials with knowledge of the case said the body of a man found riddled with bullets last week in the coastal town of Villa Joyosa belonged to Mr. Kuzminov. Andrei Cherniak, representative of Ukraine's military intel, said he could confirm the fact of his death. There was no information about the possible assailants or motive. So, very difficult to imagine that this person was not, I mean, riddled with bullets in a random town in Spain. Sounds pretty neat to me.
Like, I feel like I'm watching the Rachel Maddow show now. Come on. What is this? You've gone silent, Ben. You've been silenced.
Yeah, fair enough.
This is just literally.
No, it is totally a Rachel Maddow monologue. This could be. This last chunk, everything since he stopped criticizing Biden, could be word for word something it would be very easy to imagine Rachel Maddow saying on her show, right? There, you know, that like, yeah. I mean, and this is really telling because there's just not a lot of like there's just
he hasn't got anything to criticize, but he needs to criticize for his audience.
Yeah. Cause like here's what he can't say. Like, you know, when he refers to like the factions on the left and right or whatever, you know, he was a little vague, but, you know, like it doesn't, you know, it's pretty obvious that what he means is like, okay, the sort of Noam Chomsky kind of leftists are bad. And I also don't like the, you know, Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene type right-wing isolationists either, right? That's his point, right? So, but like, he knows that he cannot get away with his audience just saying, yeah, Tucker is awful on this. You know who's right? Joe Biden, Rachel Maddow, everybody at MSNBC, right? The pod save guys. Those are the guys who are right about this. Like that, you know, that's not a viable business proposition if you're Ben Shapiro. Right. So it's got to be that you essentially do an episode of the Rachel Maddow show, except that you have 10 minutes of, you know, of criticizing Joe Biden because he's old and he uses the wrong rhetoric, even though you yourself can't stick to the rhetoric you say that you want him to use.
His justifications are totally this is supposed to be him explaining his foreign policy worldview, but it's entirely incoherent. either he's entirely incoherent, which is entirely possible because a lot of us have inconsistent or incoherent positions at times, or he's just burying the lead what he really thinks, right? Like whether that's America should be invading everywhere because America world police, that's not going to go down well because, you know, people are critical for very concrete reasons. This hyper-interventionist foreign policy of the United States has been not great over the last 20 years, and not great even in its own terms, right? Like it's failed in the objectives that it set itself to achieve.
Yeah. Yes. Very much so. And look, you know, and
this is why, you know, again, to return to my neoconservative buddy, because he actually really is a neoconservative and he came to that position because of like whatever his ideological position was prior. That's why him and a lot of other people on the right are beginning to question it because, you know, they're not wedded to neoconservatism. They thought it was a good imperial policy. And now there is on the right greater criticism after 20 years of the failed war on terrorism. People are beginning to question it. And Ben Shapiro is like recycling nonsense arguments from 2004, but completely incoherently. He can't establish a reason why this is in our economic self-interest, or at least not one that can withstand any scrutiny. And at the same time, his appeal, his like huge monologue, Rachel Maddow monologue about Russia being bad. Yeah, Russia is an authoritarian, you know, right-wing dictatorship, whether some people, including some people on the left, want to like make it out to be, you know, the Putin being the world leader of socialism. That's a different case of, again, but that's completely marginal people. But that's not relevant to anything Shapiro says because he admits himself that this isn't about defending a democracy. Because clearly, and I'm sure Ben would if you got him on this, he would, you know, he doesn't really care about democracy in these countries anyway, because, you know, democracies might do things that the United States doesn't want them to do. There's a whole load of evidence from the last 70 years that shows that democratic decisions made by sovereign states can lead to the United States doing things to your country.
Yeah. I mean, it's such as, you know, like overthrowing elected governments, whether we're talking about, you know, governments that, you know, I might not particularly like that much either, like the, you know, government that was overthrown in the coup in Egypt with U.S. support, or governments that, you know, I do really like, you know, Salvador Allende, etc. But either way, like, yeah, I mean, that, you know, if you're sort of laying out why the U.S. has this great mission in the world, as Shapiro himself admitted earlier, you can't really say, oh, well, you know, we need to fight to the death against Vladimir Putin because he's an authoritarian dictator. And if there's one thing the United States cannot abide by, it's authoritarian dictatorships.
And this neocon argument, like you can tell he wants to make it in a certain way, but he knows it's just not going to fly in 2024. And that's partly because, you know, people make fun of Americans, you know, not knowing anything about the world outside. But there are a whole lot of Americans who over the last 20 years have been given a free year abroad courtesy of the United States military, where they've seen these parts of the world firsthand. And many of them are like, why are we even here in the first place? Why did I, you know, I just wanted the free college. And, you know, then I went and fought in a war, which even if I don't like Afghans, and I think they're all backwards, sure, terrible, you know, people, why the fuck am I here? Right. Just leave it to them, you know, let them do whatever they're going to do. So I think there's a whole load of people coming out of the military who might be right leaning, who maybe like my friend who in 2001, after 9/11 signed up for the US military and 20 years later was like, perhaps that wasn't the best response for us to do in hindsight. Still right leaning, hasn't changed any of his politics, but as a good imperialist is like, let's think of a better imperial strategy because the one we're adopting isn't working. And Shapiro just is not, he just doesn't fit the ideological moment on the right very well. It seems to me that he's, you know, kind of out of step with a lot of people on the right. Not that they're necessarily anti-imperialist in the sense that they have a principled opposition to American empire, but they just see American imperial strategy as being bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these people on the right who he's objecting to, I think the second you start to like really dig into their positions are anything but consistent anti-interventionists. You know, Tucker Carlson, who, you know, is probably the big, you know, biggest target here, given that, you know, there's been all this static between him and Ben lately, he's sort of retroactively opposed to the war in Iraq, which he was all for at the time. And, you know, he doesn't like the Ukraine policy, but it's not like he doesn't like the Ukraine policy because he's a real isolationist. He doesn't like the Ukraine policy because, you know, he thinks that Russia is a distraction for the real enemy, which is China, very explicitly, right? That's his view. And even though Tucker has recently apparently had this epiphany that the U.S. has sometimes overthrown democratic governments, he kind of seems to want to do that in Brazil and, you know, whatever. Right. But so like these people are not our friends, but that's the opposite of Shapiro's objection to them. Shapiro's objection to them is that they're too isolationist, that they're not enthusiastic enough about this kind of neocon project, that even if he's been a little bit more or less forthright than he would have been 10 or 20 years ago, Shapiro is still like entirely there for. And it's not like the fact that some of these influencers are on the right are not anymore has, or at least, you know, even if they're very inconsistent, right, they're at least rhetorically not anymore, or maybe they're even concretely not anymore in particular instances like Ukraine. It's, you know, it's this, they're responding to much larger trends that have to do with everything that you're talking about, that that they are, you know, that like their popular base has turned against that stuff. You know, one of the really telling, you know, moments in the 2016 campaign was when Trump was dunking on Jeb Bush, and Jeb was like, "Oh, my brother, you know, kept us safe." And Trump was like, "No, he didn't. What are you talking about?" Right. Like, and Republican debate audience applauded Trump for saying that. Right. Cause even if you're a Republican, like, yeah, you know, you haven't been completely asleep for the last 20 years. You have a sense that was a catastrophe. And, you know, and as you say, people who served in the military certainly often have a very vivid sense of that. Even if you didn't, you know, you just kind of have a headline news level understanding of this stuff. You know, you still, you know, it's really hard to miss that these wars in the Middle East for decades were awful and they were a catastrophe even on their own terms. And so, yeah, like the American public has, by and large, even people who think of themselves as conservatives, Republicans, or right wingers, has by and large turned against that. And, you know, you then have, you know, they're your Tucker Carlsons who see a niche appealing to that, you know, that quadrant of people. And, you know, Ben Shapiro, I think you're right that everything we watched, and that's probably what we're going to get to for tonight, but everything we watched, he's not,
he's not coherent.
He's not coherent. And the reason he's not coherent is because he knows that if he just made what's really in his heart here, which is just like a 2004 ass, you know, Paul Wolfowitz kind of argument, that, you know, that doesn't really play in 2024. Right. So it's like defending
the Ukraine war for him is especially hard because because of the polarization in the United States, the war in Ukraine is the Democratic Party's war as well. Right. So, yeah, you know, it's very much come to be seen as the Democratic Party party's war. So he, you know, if the Republicans want the war to be with China and the Democrats want to be with Russia, Ben Shapiro is what the point I think he wants to make is, why not both?
Yes, exactly. And yeah, this is just it's just a shame that that he can't, you know, convince everybody to get together behind having going all out for major confrontations with both of the other rival global powers at once. And I understand, as Mick Jagger teaches us, you can't always have what you want. But I would just recommend that, you know, if he, you know, again, as you said earlier, as sad as it is that he's not going to get a simultaneous wars with Russia and China, at the very least, the IDF is hiring, the Ukrainians are hiring. He could go off and, you know,
he doesn't have to fight. He could do his stand up. Maybe he could do one of his plays. Maybe, you know,
the Daily Wire. Oh, can you imagine what the Daily Wire USO show would be like?
I would watch that. Actually, I would watch the Daily Wire USO show.
All right, free idea, Ben. Daily Wire USO show. The boys are waiting. And with that, we are going to wrap it up for the main show for today. Thank you so much. One of our favorite returning champion guests, Mean Gene Bajelan. In so I and Jake Nandy are going now to the post game for patrons, where we actually had a collective realization that we were all a few credits short from graduating Prager University. So we're going to go there for the post game. If you are a patron, actually, I have not posted the link yet, but I'll post the link in about the next 30 seconds after the show ends. And then we will start up the post game for patrons within the next 5 minutes. Left is best.
Good night.